G'day, this is David Rutledge. Welcome to the Earshot podcast. It's great to be with you once again. The poet Jeff Page has published 21 collections of poetry and 5 verse novels. His abiding themes have been the First World War, Aboriginal dispossession, and country life, where he grew up along the Clarence River near Grafton in northern New South Wales. Jeff Page has also spent a lifetime writing about jazz, and his Aficionado, a Jazz Memoir, was published last year. In conversation with producer Mike Ladd, Jeff looks back over a 45-year career.
Jazz poet. He scrawled a sudden sentence in the air, violent yet articulate. I snatched a phrase and took it home to work on, but by dawn it was dead. It's a very early poem, actually. It came out about 1970 or 69. So.
And you've always been interested, Jeff, in jazz.
Yeah, I was in love with jazz before I was in love with poetry, really. There were 3 of us at the boarding school I was at, called TAS, the Armidale School, and somehow we all converged on jazz as opposed to rock and roll at this particular time, and we were swapping little 45s that we could manage to buy and find record players. So it was a very primitive situation, you know, we felt quite isolated from all of our other friends, you know, because we had this interest in this fairly arcane sort of music.
The interesting thing about that poem is it suggests that jazz music can do something that poetry can't.
I've had cause to think about this quite a bit over the years, and one obvious point to make is that a poem is analogous to a piece of classical music. You know, it's a composition which is sort of perfected, and then either you or other people sort of play it, interpret it, but it remains sort of static, whereas a jazz performance is always at least slightly new each time. The solos are always at least a little bit different and often profoundly different. So it's got a spontaneity that poetry doesn't have. But theoretically, it's not impossible. But one trouble is with language, it has this denotative quality, which despite a lot of avant-garde innovative poets over the years, you know, it's very hard to escape that successfully. You know, the words seem to trail their denotation. For William Carlos Williams. As with a newborn of Rutherford, you took life's drifting scraps by the feet, with worn hands slapped them into breath, and smiled to hear them bawl so wisely. William Carlos Williams was also a doctor. He practiced for 50 years, and he also wrote 50 books, and he was something of a hero of mine in my early writing days, you know, the sense that he could exist in these two worlds quite satisfactorily. And he used to write his short poems often on prescription pads, and he had his typewriter set up on a sort of a leaf of the desk so that when he didn't have a patient, he'd just whip up the typewriter and continue from where he's left off. And he's also a little bit of one of those American cranks, you know, like he reinvented poetry from the ground up in many ways.
These early poems of yours are more free-form than what you're writing now.
Yeah.
And they've got that enjambment that William Carlos Williams used. So he was an early influence on you, was he?
I definitely was an early influence, and I've kind of moved away from being close to him in technique. You know, he hardly ever used a straight iambic rhythm, but I find myself more and more drawn to the iambic over 30, 40 years, you know, so I suppose that's a reasonably free verse poem, but I haven't been writing much completely free verse in the last 20 years or so.
Why do you think that is? You've become more settled in that iambic pattern.
It's hard to sort of theorise, you know, but basically to my ear, for what I'm writing and the tone that I'm looking for, different tones, something that's fairly iambic just sounds more finished, sounds more musical, sounds more perfected than my free verse does. You know, I really like the best free verse. I have absolutely nothing against it, and I rather wish I could write more of it.
Another big element in your work besides jazz and music is the First World War. Why your particular focus on the First World War?
Well, I did an anthology called Shadows from Wire back in the early 80s. And I think in the late 70s, early 80s, that quite a lot of Australian poets were kind of reacting to the Vietnam War or their recent memory of the Vietnam War by equating it to some extent with World War One. You know, there seemed to be a similar pointlessness about it. There seemed to be a reason for cynicism and a reason for criticism, you know. So World War One, in a way, was the ideal sort of pacifist war, you know. At that time, I know there's been some more recent historical work that suggests that Germany perhaps had more to blame than people thought in the 1970s. But I was one of a group, I think, who reacted to the memory of World War One and found it hugely tragic, you know, and also had the feeling that it almost could have been avoided. You know, it was a diplomatic catastrophe, a series of lurches that could have been avoided by a bit more political nous. This poem, Christ at Gallipoli, is based on an experience I had in 1970 when I went to the dawn service in Canberra at the War Memorial, and I heard a padre talk in a way that implied or was explicitly saying that God was on our side in all of our wars. And having done a little bit of research on World War One and realising that Dirks and the Germans also had a similar view, I was struck by the contradictions involved in that statement. So I went home, and in only a couple of drafts, I wrote this poem called Christ at Gallipoli. And it starts with a quote from the Anglican Synod in Melbourne in 1916. This synod is convinced that the forces of the Allies are being used of God to vindicate the rights of the weak and to maintain the moral order of the world. Bit weird at first, that starry look in the eyes, the hair down past his shoulders. But after a go with the ship's barber, a seawater shower and the old slouch hat across his ears, he started to look the part. Took him a while to get the way a bayonet fits the old Enfield. But going in on the boats, he looked calmer than any of us, just gazing in over the swell where the cliffs look black against the sky. When we hit, he fairly raced in through the waves, then up the beach, swerving like a fullback at the end, when the Turks had really got onto us. Time you all caught up, he was off like a flash, up the cliffs, after his first machine gun. He'd done for three Turks when we got there. The fourth was a gibbering mess. Seeing him wave that blood-red bayonet, I reckon we were glad to have him on the side. This poem called Inscription at Villers Bretonneux is based on experience I had in 1973 when I visited Bat Cemetery, which is one of the major Australian cemeteries in France. And I was looking at all the inscriptions, and the inscriptions all followed the consensus. They died for king and country and so on. And then I just read one inscription which totally broke ranks, and I started to think about why that was and how that happened. The dead at Villers Bretonneux rise gently on a slope towards the sky. The land is trim, skylines of ploughed earth and steeples, unfallen rain still hanging in the air. Confusion smoothed the way, and everything put back. The village too, red brick, white sills, in 1920, unchanged since. Headstones speak a dry consensus. Just one breaks free. Lives lost, hearts broken, and for what? I think of the woman and those she saddened by insisting, the Melbourne clerk who must have let it through. This poem, My Mother's God, goes back to when I was 19 or so, and I thought of myself at that point as a Christian, and I belonged to the student Christian movement at university, and my mother and I used to have quite a few sort of religious arguments, and her view of God was rather different to mine. My mother's God has written the best of the Protestant proverbs. You make the bed, you lie in it. God helps him who helps himself. He tends to shy away from churches, is more to be found in phone calls to daughters or rain clouds over rusty grass. The Catholics have got him wrong entirely. Too much waving the arms about, the incense and caftan, that rainbow light. He's leaner than that, lean as a pair of grocer's scales, hard as a hammer at cattle sales, the third and final time of asking. His face is most clear in a scrubbed wooden table, or deep in the shine of a Laminex bench. He's also observed at weddings and funerals, by strict invitation, not knowing quite which side to sit on. His second book, my mother says, is often now too well received. The first is where the centre is, tooth for claw and eye for tooth. Whoever tried the other cheek? Well, Christ maybe, but that's another story. God, like her, by dint of coursework, has a further degree in predestination. Immortal, omniscient, no doubt of that, he nevertheless keeps regular hours and wipes his feet clean on the mat. He's not to be seen at 3 in the morning. His portrait, done in a vigorous charcoal, is fixed on the inner curve of her forehead. Omnipotent there, in broad black strokes, he does not move. It is not easy, she'd confess, to be my mother's God.
So, do you have a God now, yourself?
No, I always describe myself as an agnostic. Well, I have in the last 30 or so years, yeah. The importance of doubt is really important to me. You know, I think that it's just something that's you can hardly overestimate the importance of.
And I guess the other thing in this poem is the concept that we tend to make gods in the image of ourselves.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I call it secular Protestantism, you know, that people of a certain temperament, a certain culture and a certain tradition, they tend to create God in almost in their own image, in this case reduced to something that's of practical use to us. This next poem is called The Clarence at Copmanhurst, and it reflects an ongoing concern that I've had with this particular river, which is in northern New South Wales, and the town of Grafton is the major town that's set on it. And it's become symbolic to me over time. I think rivers have been symbolic in, you know, Western thought, going back to the Greeks. particular rivers have a particular resonance, and if you grow up beside a river, then I think you're emotionally attached to it for the rest of your life. And the cattle station I grew up on had a beautiful view both up and down the river. We lived on a bluff just about a couple of hundred feet above the river, and the rapids and the river pools and so on, they just came into my poetry very naturally. Copmanhurst is sort of at that exact point when the tidal part of the river starts and the freshwater part of the river ends. That's also where I went to primary school. For 40 years I've driven past this moment, a half mile down a side road from the tar, this point where two halves of a river meet, where once I know my small limbs must have swum. Downstream, all is tidal. Upstream are the pools, the rapids, lazy conversation. The lower half moves eastward to the sea, a single body lifting to the moon, and splits itself around the Delta Islands, skylines of cane still tied to half-forgotten ferries before it roughens on the bar. The other ripples downwards from the right, a patterning of sunlight over stones. Down from all the higher pools, the rapids measure in between. Pools of perch, freshwater mullet, the cruising little heads of turtles, the cattle cut off at the knees and drinking their reflections, the mountains standing in one side and backing off the other. To the left there, it's a different stillness, another kind of mullet, feeding in the shallows. The flats downstream run outwards to the hills, blue lines on a far horizon. It is a classic day in winter. The midday sun slows down an hour to warm my southern bones. The sandstone scarp across the water there is fledged with trees. They perch in cracks and lean out dryly from the cliff as if to wave. On this side, it's alluvial, a kind of shelf from which to view the other bank. So clearly it's a campsite, this juncture of the fresh and salt, millennia of smoke. And somewhere, too, I hear a story no one's heard for years, or no one that I know. Dirangan, in her maddened damming, might well have paused here once, retreating on her way by stages before she vanished into stone. But it's just this one warm winter's day, one of a million either side, that reach out to the left and right. There's no one on the main road now. It must be a tractor downstream somewhere, working on a loosened flat, that single jet trail overhead, the wine too far behind to catch. The sounds from here are low and equal, like mist they're lifted by the sun, which lets them float and disappear. Who could know that 40 years would make so much forgetting? I stand here where two rivers meet and feel them both as separate lives, the upstream clarity of pools, the downstream salt of lower reaches, heading for the sea. Although I was the eldest of five boys and two girls, I chose not to go on the property, and three of my brothers have since continued on that property, and I go back there at least once a year and look at it again, and occasionally I think, you know, I could have done this, but much more often I think I have no desire to do this. And yet the sheer beauty of the place is very real, and I think it's real even to the brothers who've stayed there and slaved away at what is essentially a sort of physical job. So this is called The Homestead. High above the Clarence now, I'm talking on this tall veranda, heirloom of my brothers. It looks out on the downstream view, hazed and deepened with September, this scattering of burn-off fires, the blues, the browns, the greens, the greys, unified by smoke, as are the levels of the air, the levels of the river. I have to tell myself, firstborn, why none of this is mine. The sweat, the boredom and the bank, the entropy of fences, the tiredness in the bones at evening, the branding iron, the cutting knives, the squalling calves and moaning mothers, the auctioneer's uneven song, the cow shit shin-deep in the crushes, the murmur too I caught much later of Bunjalung millennia, the peoples of the river, whose voices now I still can hear, sometimes on a telephone, more often in the rapids. 2 days driving to the south, I have a first floor slice of air and cut to other mountains. 83 square metres neat complete my acreage, nothing extra to requirement. Why is it then things don't add up? Half pain, half pleasure, half relief, and something in the eye's delight. Why is it that I still return? Why is it that I need to have my ashes in the river?
Another big thing in your work is the theme of Aboriginal dispossession.
Yeah.
And that seems to have been a real project in your work, going right through your verse plays as well as your lyric poems.
I used to think, you know, World War I is a kind of a baptism of fire and the country had been more or less innocent up until then. But really, when we discover about the frontier wars from the 1840s onwards and some ways from 1790 through to 1926 and maybe later, there's a whole other history there, which, of course, Henry Reynolds and some other historians have examined in detail. And I made a bit of a habit of following up Henry's footnotes and finding a richness of poetic material there. The issue is so important, not simply a matter of guilt, which is a kind of a disabling emotion for everybody, but just a need to know much more precisely, if not ever absolutely precise, but more precisely, what happened so that, you know, something intelligent and morally satisfactory can be built on that understanding. I think that's what most Aboriginal people want, you know, is not a statement of guilt, but a correct interpretation of the past, a mutual past. Yeah, this poem's The Squatter's Thesaurus. It comes from one such article written about the different words that were used, euphemisms to describe the frequent attacks of different kinds on Aboriginal people in the period from, say, 1840 to about 1890 in particular. The frontier runs are cleared by language. My old niggers are dispersed. The Bible and Charles Darwin both declare the sons of Cain are cursed. Two squatters on a front veranda put their feet up to relax and talk of last month's dressing down or proper thumping of the blacks. That lad of mine, one squatter smiles, is much too keen on rushing gins. We had a parson by last month pronouncing on the seven sins. Vigorous measures must be taken. Outrages are up again. Time, it seems, to be doing the needful. They need a dusting now and then. Bodies strewn about like saplings are dragged into a pile and burnt. The future talks of settlement, and murder is a language learnt.
This ground has been made sacred by the bravery and sacrifice of those who lie buried here. Young men who died in defence of their country and in the name of freedom. 50 years ago, Australian Allied servicemen came to join their compatriots in Papua New Guinea to face the Japanese advance on Port Moresby. Many of them were no more than 18 years old. Their deeds must never be forgotten.
Kokoda Corrective, which begins with a statement by Paul Keating that he made there in 1992. It was here young Australian men fought for the first time against the prospect of the invasion of their country. And the poems are written from the point of view of one of the soldiers buried at Kokoda. Or first that could be counted, any rate, all lined up here underground and numbered from the right. The others were a good bit sooner, 100 years or so, their skulls much further out of sight or overseas in glass. Old Pemulwuy of the Eora, now he gave trouble for a time, dozen years to be exact, and Yeagan on the Upper Swan, his head was souvenired as well, if I recall. And Windradeen, out Bathurst way, required a whiff of martial law before he saw the light. And Pigeon in the Kimberley, now there's a bloke who liked to fight. Good that you could make it, Paul. Nice to see that someone came. Not actually the first, not quite, but damn fine all the same. This poem's called Codicil, which is a small extra clause that one adds to one's will. So this actually exists with my will, you know, I've put this poem down with that legal document. Codicil. And then, when you've acquired the ashes, that crushed white gravel in a box, carry them north to the Clarence River, a two-day trip to close the curve. Late spring or early summer, October might be best, and check before you leave it's not in flood. The time, I think, might be, say, 5 o'clock, just when the shade comes off the mountain. The water will be almost still, a deep, unending green, with one faint, indecisive breeze to bend the surface slightly. The heat by then will start to lift, the river start to fill with evening. Pause here, now, together, briefly. Then one of you, my son, I think, will take the box, remove the lid, and in a single, easy sweep, disperse my body on the river. If done with grace, it ought to make a long descending curve, as if a net were being cast. You'll hear then just the slightest sound, a run of sand across the water, the near end hitting first, and then the high reach of the arc. And when you've finished this, my son, I'd have you pause 2 minutes more before you climb the bank again and let the upstream view delight your eyes.
The poetry of Jeff Page. Sound engineer was Tom Henry, and the program was produced by Mike Ladd. Jeff's new selected poems is published by Puncher and Wattman. For more details, check the Earshot website. And that's it for the Earshot podcast. If you're not yet a subscriber, then you can find us via the ABC Radio app. You can also hear us via the ABC Radio player. We have an increasingly extensive back catalogue of programs, all of them wonderful feature documentaries. So get in there and have a dig around. Thanks for your company. I'm David Rutledge. See you next time.
On Background Briefing, power bill price gouging.
I thought, wow, this is extraordinary. How can they do that?
And bills could go up another $500.
The networks are still seeking to milk the system for what it's worth.
And it's driving the next solar revolution.
Really, for 100 years, network companies haven't had to contend with a competitor. Then solar comes along as this cheap alternative and their revenue starts dropping away.
Listen to this Background Briefing anytime from the RN website.